Hello, coaches, and welcome back to another episode of the ABCA's Calls from the Clubhouse, our podcast where we connect with some of the best baseball minds in the game today. On behalf of the American Baseball Coaches Association, we'd like to take this opportunity to sincerely thank you for listening in each week and enjoying our podcast, and we know that you're going to enjoy this one as well. If you're interested in previous episodes, please go to our website, abca.org. You can click on the Resources tab at the top. Calls from the Clubhouse podcast link is there for you. You can click on that and find us. You can also head over to iTunes. You can subscribe to our podcast. It'll show up on your phone every time we publish one. Give us a 5-star rating and review. We'd love to hear from you on that. Also on social media, you can find us on Twitter, at ABCA1945. You can also find us on Facebook, ABCA1945. And if you have topics, you have coaches out there that you think would be great fits for our podcast, please reach out to us by email, Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at abca.org. My name is Jeremy Schieninger, and I had the great pleasure of sitting down and talking with an ABCA loyal strength and conditioning coach, Eric Cressy. Eric is the founder of Cressy Sports Performance. He trains more than 100 pro players, very involved in baseball, and has been up on our main stage a couple of times in 2012 out in Anaheim and also in 2014 in Dallas. Eric is a passionate, baseball-minded strength and conditioning coach. He's going to give us great insight into how to train our players, keep them healthy, keep them on the field, and really help give us some tremendous insight into that process. We hope you enjoy the episode. Thank you for listening in. And again, we appreciate what you're doing for the game of baseball. All right, Eric, man, thanks for being on with us today. How's everything going your way? What are you into these days?
Going great. Thanks for having me. Just getting ready for another day in the office with guys kind of starting their kind of a brief off season before summer ball really kicks into high gear up here.
It's getting rocking and rolling. I know guys are transitioning out of their playing seasons for most of them, the high school or the college, or now the professionals really ramping up. But kind of talk through kind of your day-to-day right now.
Yeah, the day-to-day is actually probably a little bit different every day. We also have facilities both here in Massachusetts where I am now and also down in Jupiter, Florida. So my year is kind of split where I'm in Florida from about mid-September until mid-April, and then I come back up to Massachusetts. So I kind of go wherever it's busiest. So Mass is kind of the hotbed for summer ball, where, you know, as close as like 75 minutes to some Cape teams and some are a couple hours. Whereas Florida is kind of a little bit more of our hotbed for professional training in the off season. So it'll generally vary depending on which location I'm at. You know, I'll give you kind of like a typical off season day in Florida is I'm usually up by about 5:30 in the morning and trying to get as much work as I can in before my daughters wake up. And I have twin 18-month-old daughters. And then we get in, we start up with our pro guys around 10. That'll generally roll until about 3 o'clock. And there's the high school crowd that kind of comes in afterwards. So I'm a little bit less involved on the high school side as I used to be, but I have some great business partners and staff members in both cases that kind of take the baton there. And usually, so I'm generally on the floor interacting directly with athletes roughly 5 to 6 hours a day. And then, you know, it's taking place basically 6 days a week for all that time. And then I get a little chance to catch my breath once the season actually starts. And then we move back up to Massachusetts and start it all over again with the college crowd.
And that kind of opens us up to this, Eric, man. Like, you're spending time, especially in the off season, with more than 100 guys that are dealing in professional baseball. And I think it'd be great. Our listeners would love to kind of get a glimpse into how are those guys. We obviously understand the grind of the season, but when those guys are coming out of that season, how are they moving into that training and how are you guiding them preparing for the next season?
You know, it's definitely an individual thing because, you know, if you look at like your typical minor league guy, right, most of those guys are going to wrap up their season within the first week or two of September, depending on whether they go to playoffs. But you also have to sort out is some guys maybe get 3 to 4 weeks off and then have to go back for instructs. Some guys may, you know, have decided to play winter ball. And then there are some guys literally that may have only thrown like, you know, minor league reliever can throw 35 innings, whereas you might get guys who throw 180. So you really have to individualize that side of things. I'd say the first month of the offseason, usually guys I encourage take about a week. Always drives me bonkers when guys just do nothing for an entire month because you miss out on just so much valuable time to start identifying and addressing you know, mobility and stability deficits that need to be taken care of while guys aren't throwing. But I'd say most of those guys shut down for that first week, whether they're moving back home or wherever it may be, and then we'll get going. That first month is very much targeted towards, like I mentioned, you know, working on mobility and stability things that we have, whether it's, you know, lots of hip mobility, you know, limited elbow extension, you know, whatever it may be. We want to start to address those early on, get cuff strength back up, get their body weight normalized, you know, just because that stuff is all going to be harder once they start throwing again. So we don't have to compete with throwing nearly as much. So we get to work right away on that. We don't do a lot of aggressive, like, rotational med ball stuff. We don't really do any sprinting within that first month. We'll actually do a little bit of, like, extended mobility circuits with little rest between sets to kind of, you know, basically ride two horses in one saddle. We can obviously optimize the mobility with using those exercises, but at the same time we can get their heart rate up, build a little bit of aerobic base so that we set a foundation for, from a systemic standpoint, they're in a good position to tolerate a higher volume of work and recover between outings and stuff. So, you know, we can kill two birds with one stone, so to speak, early in the off season by doing that. And I think it's just a better option than having them distance run or just, you know, do a half an hour on the elliptical or something like that. Once we get past that first month, their strength is going up, their body weight's getting where it needs to be, maybe they're leaning out, whatever it may be, that's when we start to get pretty aggressive with, like, our rotational med ball stuff, and we start to work with some of our sprint progressions and change of direction stuff. So really, from about mid to late October up through those first couple weeks in January, we're really aggressive with our med ball work. We're doing a lot of what we would call closed-loop sprint progression. So, you know, more, you know, fine coaching of, you know, actual positioning, shin angles, things along those lines. Once January rolls around, guys start to throw and hit a lot more, so there's a lot more baseball activities. So when that time rolls around, we scale back on the amount of med ball stuff we do. We also tend to change a lot of our, like, kind of movement progressions around, where maybe they're responding to a stimulus, you know, they're coach-directed sprints and, you know, hip turns to chase down fly balls, things along those lines. And, you know, all this is taking place. You know, the weight room volume is kind of coming down the more the baseball activity ramps up before guys report. But, you know, all on the off season, most of our guys – we'll start throwing. It really can be anywhere from, like, November 1st all the way up to the 1st of January. If you have a minor league reliever who is a, you know, 39th round draft pick who's a 5'10 righty throwing 88 and you only threw 30 innings, you got to get to work and really build a little bit more arm speed and, you know, build something that's not going to get released in spring training. So you probably have to push him earlier. Whereas, you know, if you have a big league guy, you know, like Corey Kluber is one of our guys. Corey threw, you know, 236 innings 1 year, 225 another over the past couple of years. And so Corey, you know, didn't start throwing in, I think, until like December 18th or something like that last year. So we really try to individualize a lot to their workload, how they're feeling, and what's expected of them when they do show up.
I would venture to think, Eric, that, you know, a guy, like you said, you mentioned Kluber, like a guy that's established in professional baseball, he's doing great things, making his money, but he's been through this and he understands how his body reacts and what he really needs to be prepared. And then you've got, you know, conversely, you've got the guy that's really trying to break in. He's trying to maybe get out of instructs and get into, you know, long season, you know, short A or double A and move up. Talk about those two, dealing with those two, like I said, on an individual basis. Those two guys are going to train differently, think differently.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because, like, one of the hardest questions that I ever get asked is, like, hey, what's your philosophy? And I would be like, and then the answer is, like, who's the athlete? You know, a guy like Corey is incredibly self-motivated. Like, I never have to give him a hard time to get working like that. Like, he literally is just tunnel vision. You put something on paper and he's going to do it to a T. Like, without fail, like, he's ready for a new program. He gives me a one-week heads up. So I have time to put it together. We have time to communicate about what's working, what isn't, what we need to change. And, I mean, that's just how he goes about his business. There are other guys that it's not a criticism or just different, you know, like, you know, maybe they're not as, like, regimented in the way that they carry their lives. And that's okay. You know, you want him to, you know, learn from a guy like Corey, but not necessarily expect him to be just like him. So I think every situation is unique, not just in terms of their personality, but the physical aspect of it. So, like, Steve Cishek's another one of our guys. Steve ran into some kind of, like, mechanical issues. He's got a little bit of a high-maintenance arm slot where if he creeps up too much, his velocity goes up, but, you know,
know, the sinker kind of flattens out. If he gets too low, you know, he kind of throws like those cement mixer sliders, and you know, the velo drops a little bit. So it's something that he has to kind of relearn every offseason. So, you know, Steve and I literally texted me an hour after their last game at the end of last season. Was like, hey, let's sit down, let's talk about this. And we went out to breakfast a week later, and we literally, you know, spent a couple hours mapping out the whole offseason to say, hey, you're going to start throwing a little bit earlier. We want to really make sure that this is, you know, where we're at and all that. So he's had a great year so far with the Mariners, the velo's up, and, you know, he's gotten away from some of those things that he struggled with in the past. So what I try to do is, and this is my background, I was a baseball player up until eighth grade. I was a third baseman. I took up catching when I was like 26 just because we needed catchers. You know, my first bullpen I ever caught was Tim Collins, who's got one of the best curveballs in baseball. So I'm an outsider. I have to do a lot more listening. I have to ask a lot of questions. And I think guys really appreciate that because they feel like they're really able to take an active role in their training process. They're able to take ownership of the results that they have. I think if you asked most of our guys how they would describe our training with them, and I hope the response would be before they even talk about the experience and all that, they would speak to the fact that it's kind of like a family environment. They feel like they can talk to us about anything, give us feedback, and really take a role in everything that occurs. So I want that dialogue because it's what makes us, I think, successful in what we do.
That's great. And you just brought up a nice little point is that specific baseball coaches, we want to teach our guys in a way that they can really be their own best coach. You know, if you need a coach to always hover over you and fix your swing and make those adjustments, that's not going to really translate to the game. And it's kind of along those same lines. You want to lay out a plan. You want to have that great feedback between player and yourself. But then ultimately, he needs to follow his plan, be his own strength coach, in essence, and you just kind of keep him on the right track. Is that about right?
Absolutely. And, you know, so a funny story about that. Honestly, when I was earlier on in my career, back in the offseason of 2008-09, I actually started working with Curt Schilling. So Curt was 41 years old. He'd had the first subpectoral biceps tendinitis in the history of Major League Baseball. It's like a new surgery. They're still not doing a lot of them. So I was fortunate to work with Curt late in his rehab. And you know, beyond just obviously learning a lot from him on the science of pitching and his experiences and things like that, one of the things that he was always really good about was taking younger guys under his wing. So like when he was at the facility, he would always, you know, talk with the minor league guys and things like that. Back around that time, I had some younger guys that were training with us, two kind of right-handed pitchers in particular that I thought were pretty good. So I brought him over to hang out with him one day. He still had his video game company, and it was only about 15 minutes away from him. I think they had like a day off for like teachers in service and work or something like that. So, you know, I told the guys, hey, we're going over for a ride. I mean, this is like 2009 in Boston. You know, basically right. Schilling was a huge, huge name at that point, and, you know, a year and a half removed from a World Series. So we went over, and, you know, the kids are like, obviously they're both sophomores in high school at the time, super starstruck, and, you know, they sat down and like, listened, they asked a lot of questions, and one of his biggest takeaways from that conversation was, I remember him telling them distinctly, don't be that guy that gives up an eight spot over two innings and then has to take the next 4 to 5 days to figure it out. Be that guy that can make that adjustment after the first inning or even after the first batter, who can self-correct, you know, when you throw a bad pitch, know what your mistake was and what it is you do differently, because, you know, as you go through this process, you're going to have 100 different pitching coaches. You're going to have a different catcher. You're going to have catchers that speak different languages. You're going to have all these different things, and the one consistent thing in the process is going to be you and how you handle yourself and all that. And what's kind of funny about that whole dynamic was those two kids, both of them were drafted 2.5 years later, basically. Tyler Beattie went 21st overall to the Blue Jays and wound up turning down $2.5 million, and Adam Ravenel went later in like the 40-something round and didn't sign. So they both went to Vanderbilt. They were roommates at Vandy, won a national championship together. Tyler wound up being the 14th overall pick for the San Francisco Giants in 2014. Adam was a fourth rounder. He was a closer. He actually closed the Vanderbilt World Series. Tyler's up to 99 this year. Adam's up to 100 in high with the Tigers. So it's just like, you know, those guys were great pitchers then, and they were on a good trajectory already. But, you know, I wonder if some of those tidbits, you know, many years later have made a pretty significant difference in the way that they kind of self-correct and how they go about their business.
As we kind of talk through this, and I hope our listeners remember seeing you on our main stage when you were back in 14 in Dallas, and then you also spoke in 2012 in Anaheim and reference the fact that you are one of the leaders out here in the strength and conditioning realm.
with Cressy Sports Performance. But, you know, your baseball, in terms of how you've been entrenched in this game, is still even much deeper than what we're diving into. But the one I really want to kind of get to, and I want to just kind of get your experience, is you got to travel with the USA Baseball 18U team as you guys went to the obviously the World Cup in 15. Talk through that experience a little bit, dealing with those guys.
How it all came about, actually, several years ago, I was actually speaking at an event, and actually Derek Johnson was supposed to speak there. It was right when he was hired as the minor league pitching coordinator for the Cubs, and because of the nature of the scheduling, he wasn't able to do the event. And the organizer asked him, you know, who would you recommend for a replacement? And his recommendation was Sean Cole, who had just won a national championship mm-hmm. at the University of Arizona. And Sean and I both spoke at this event. We really hit it off. I remember, you know, just talking with him for an extensive period of time there, and I was like, man, this guy is sharp. Like, I really like dealing with him. And he went to Arizona, obviously was there quite a while, and we stayed in touch. And, you know, whenever he'd have a question about an athlete, he'd give me a buzz. And, you know, I reached out to him a couple times, getting his take on what's working, what wasn't. We just always had a really good dialogue. And when Sean left Arizona, he actually became the director of the 18-year national team selection process. So it was really, you know, a largely evaluative role instead of kind of a coaching role, where he had to really know the best, you know, high school players in the country to know who was going to be a fit. So he won the Pan American Games with them in 2014. And then he asked me if I'd be interested in doing the strength and conditioning stuff for the national team in 2015 when we were going to Osaka. So I was thrilled. I mean, I had an opportunity to work with some awesome coaches, Glenn Cicchini and Greg Moore and David Eckstein and Eric Kibler, just a really good coaching staff. So, I mean, I was, you know, I was very much like it was interesting for me because it was really the first time I'd been in a dugout in about as long as I can remember. So I saw the game from a different perspective. But it was eye-opening a lot of ways to kind of see, you know, especially like starting off at the Tournament of Stars in North Carolina, just kind of seeing where like the best of the best are right now. Because I always see it in my world, in the strength and conditioning world, and I see it in smaller sample size. You know, we'll see the top, you know, 8 to 10 players in the Northeast on a regular basis, and we'll see guys in our Florida facility from the Southeast. But when you see, you know, that many guys all in one place, and you see them in the midst of competition, and you get a feel for some of their practices in terms of how they bounce back between starts, what they do for their pregame routines, it just gives you a unique perspective on it. And what was probably most interesting about my role at USA is, you know, the title was kind of strength and conditioning coach, but I would actually argue that a lot more of my stuff was more about like recovery, warm-up protocols, nutrition, mm-hmm. things like that, just trying to keep guys, you know, feeling good every time they get on the field, you know, as opposed to getting them in the weight room and absolutely crushing them. I think most of the guys, you know, probably got in, you know, 3 to 4 lifts in the month that we were together between our training camp at Fullerton, you know, our brief stay in Taiwan for some exhibitions, and then our actual time in Japan for the World Cup. So it was a very good eye-opening experience that I think above all else, the number one thing that I took away in terms of the way that we can, you know, continue to help our high school guys, particularly our really advanced prospects, is they need to learn routines. And that's individual to everybody. They've got to figure out what it is that works for them, and they've got to be adherent to it, not deviate from it. And they've got to realize that really all their decisions directly impact their success, right? So staying up late, maybe not eating the best food, you know, not monitoring their hydration, things like that. Those things all snowball, and those small hinges can swing really big doors. So that was kind of the wisdom I tried to impart on a lot of those guys, is that, you know, if you take care of your body the right way, you know, here we are at the absolute end of your season, you're not feeling awesome necessarily, but you can still, you know, dig deep, find that 95 when you've been 92, 93 the last couple weeks. And, you know, it was an awesome experience. I got to interact with a lot of coaches and a lot of great players and get a ring out of it.
Which is always the cherry on top. In terms of kind of, Eric, how you go about things, and I think, you know, we're going to kind of start moving towards getting more specific throughout this talk, but the proof is in the pudding in terms of how you're going about it, your training techniques and your almost philosophy or methodology behind what you're doing. But you're having success with your guys, your clients, of increasing throwing velocity, which obviously from the arm standpoint, everybody's looking for. From the hitting standpoint, you're increasing bat speed. From the, you know, the athlete standpoint, you're really increasing sprint speed. But here's the kicker: you're really keeping the injury rate down. So you're preparing these guys to be as explosive as they can be in all facets, but you're keeping them healthy. Talk us through the best you can in terms of some insight into how you're getting that done.
Yeah, and the answer, like I mentioned before, is probably unique to everybody, but there certainly are commonalities of success with guys. And one of the things I think is really important early on is, you know, I know there are a lot of coaches listening to this, and there are going to be people out there that sell you the holy grail of injury prevention or arm care or velocity development or whatever it is. Really, the secret is that there's no secret. The answer is different for absolutely everybody, and anybody that tries to tell you that they have all the answers, you know, doesn't have the answers, because it's the problems that we're facing right now, the injury epidemics, the Tommy John surgeries on a daily basis, those are incredibly multifactorial. I mean, we had a study that really just came out on like 9 to 12-year-old Japanese pictures, and I believe it was like over 60% of the guys actually have, you know, UCL damage when you MRI them at that young an age. So a lot of the kids that we're getting in high school, we're getting in college, we're getting pro ball, these are already damaged goods. So we can do things 100% picture perfect. We can change their life with great training. We can optimize mechanics. We can put them on the perfect throwing program. And there are still going to be guys that get hurt just because throwing a baseball is the single fastest motion in all of sports. And, you know, it always has been, but now it's happening with even higher velocities than ever before. Your physics, you know, force equals mass times acceleration. Mass, the ball hasn't changed, but the acceleration absolutely has. There's more forces on these joints than ever before, and when they're showing up, they're a little more banged up. That's where things are getting more and more problematic. And likewise, we've got a more specialized game with, you know, guys throwing cutters and, you know, guys only having to throw an inning as opposed to, you know, relievers being extended out a little bit more. You know, relievers are more expendable, I guess, than ever before at the big league level in the eyes of a lot of organizations. So injuries are really, really multifactorial. So I think what we do is, you know, we have to, in a general sense, look at things as stuff we control and stuff we don't control. You know, we can definitely control pitch counts. We can control hydration status. We can control strength conditioning. We can control, you know, all these different things, whether we call 70% sliders and 30% fastballs or, you know, vice versa. There are going to be things that we can't control, right? We can't control what an athlete's injury history is before us. You know, we can't control, you know, that, you know, weather conditions, things along those lines that are really, really hard to manage. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, you know, most people have kind of flocked to like the overuse camp is let's manage pitch counts, let's restrict when kids can start throwing curveballs and things like that. And I think it's a noble initiative, but what it is, it's very much a Band-Aid on a, you know, kind of a large gaping wound. I have, you know, strong feelings about that stuff. I do think there's a place for pitch counts, and I think most of the time it's a little bit of common sense. But I think beyond that, we have to get back to looking at like a culture that really understands long-term athletic development, and making sure that kids aren't heavily overused and basically damaged goods at a young age. I don't know if you've read Jeff Passan's new book, The Arm. And I actually really enjoyed the book from even just like a perspective of here's what athletes go through during the Tommy John procedure, and also like the after the fact, like guys who may have a second surgery and things along those lines. But you know, I thought one of the probably the most interesting parts of the book, that was really just a couple paragraphs that I think a lot of people might glaze over, but it was a very important reminder, is that one of the things he talked about is that it seems like if guys are able to get past a certain point, they stay healthy. So, you know, you see these guys who are getting hurt at 18, 19, 20, but if you see that guy who somehow does what, like, Clayton Kershaw has done, or, you know, what some of these other guys who have managed to get to this, like, certain threshold without having that elbow or shoulder surgery, there's something to be said about just getting a certain amount of time, because it seems like the best predictor of injury is a previous injury. So what I think it speaks to is if we can do a better job at the high school and the college levels, we can get these guys to 24, 25 without them having some high level of pathology, they actually seem to do pretty well. And that's the thing that I think is a big challenge, because you know, the high school side of things is probably going to be where we're dealing with stuff that's like the least regulated. Guys may try to play on both high school and travel teams. You know, the innings can climb up really high. One of the things that we struggle with is at our Florida facility, you know, the high school season actually starts the second week in January. And they only play two games a week, and it'll go all the way up through early May. So, like, you'll actually see high school pitchers who've got 80 or 90 innings under their belt before they even go to summer ball. So the question becomes, is this a responsibility of the high school coach to keep the innings low? Is it responsible of the summer ball coach keep the innings down. And that's where it becomes a conundrum, is that, you know, when you have a kid that's got 130 or 140 innings on his arm, and, you know, he's rolling around to, you know, the beginning of August, and all of a sudden he's got, you know, Under Armour, perfect game, All-American games. He's got the area code games. He may have USA Baseball, like all these different things. These guys are coasting on fumes when they're in the highest pressure environment by the end of the season. Now, if you contrast that to a high school kid in Massachusetts, they don't start their season until the third Monday in March. Usually the first 2 weeks are off a turf mound in a gymnasium, or they're out shoveling off the fields. It's physically right. impossible to really top like 50 or 60 innings in the high school season in Massachusetts. That'd be really, really hard to do. And then you roll into the summer, and all of a sudden you see these guys it's a challenge to hit 100 innings as a high school player in the Northeast. And that seems to be a big part of why these guys are able to have better longevity, not run into as many problems. So I think the other issue we see with that Florida schedule is if you're a baseball player in Florida, you cannot play basketball. There's no way physically possible it happened, and you really don't even see that many guys that play like football and baseball or soccer and baseball. It's the schedule simply like pushes out playing another sport. So up here in Massachusetts, we'll have kids that play football, hockey, and then baseball. You know, they might play golf in the summertime, so they're still multi-sport athletes all along. And going back to the examples of Tyler and Adam, Tyler was a three-sport athlete, football, basketball, baseball as a freshman. He gave up basketball his sophomore year, so he still played two sports. Then his junior year, he actually stuck with just baseball and actually wound up missing football and went back and played football as a senior in high school. So he's a multi-sport athlete all the way through. Adam was a guy who was a three-sport athlete as a freshman. He was a two-sport athlete as a sophomore and a junior, and he's a one-sport athlete as a senior. So the specialization came later. That just doesn't happen in warm weather states. It's, you know, I can't – for the last time I saw a first-round pick out of Florida that was a renowned, you know, defensive back on the high school football team or something like that. So it's just the direction the game is going, and I think it's unfortunate. And I think what it leads to is it leads to – some college, some pro coaches, and even some high school coaches that they get put in a tough spot when a kid gets hurt and it's on them. But in reality, it's a lot of the stuff that predated them.
You're dead on there. That is such a trend that people are spending more time paying attention to. And I think the injury rate does that. It alarms coaches, it alarms parents and players. And you're starting to see that trend where it went to specialization. It is starting to circle back towards, you know, like you mentioned, those players in the Northeast that get the experiences of all different sports. But when you really, you know, dive into what that means they're getting a break. Their bodies are getting a break from throwing baseballs and doing those things that we all understand the damage that can come from that. But it's, you mentioned something, Eric, and obviously talking about Adam and his development before we got going, that long-term development process, and you couldn't have said it any better. There are certain habits and success patterns of players that are really the cream of the crop. There's things that they do and things that they go about their business. And I want you to really dive into that long-term development process that you're seeing.
You know, the first thing I would say is it piggybacks on the last point is that they do find time away from their sport. One of the things that I think is actually really surprising, and it's a dramatically stark difference between high school players and pro players. High school players, they always want to play. They're ready to get in games no matter what. So, like, you know, they're ready to just go no matter what. I've never heard anybody that was, like, not looking forward to baseball. Like, if you've ever interacted with a Major League Baseball, like, starting pitcher at the end of a season, like, they don't want to look at a baseball. Like, we had one guy that hit a career high in innings last year, and his wife called me, like, a week into the off season and was like, you need to get him out of the house. Like, he's, like, in his room. He hasn't showered for, like, 2 days. All he's doing is watching Netflix. Like, they're, like, almost, like, clinically depressed because they are so sick of baseball.
Sure,
so it's,
sure.
It's, like, it's such a stark contrast where these guys don't even want to think about throwing for months because the workload is so high. So what's interesting, though, is you'll see that with pro guys who throw 150 innings when the season wraps up. And then you see the high school kid that in some cases has thrown 150 innings, which is absurd, and they're all fired up about it. So I think part of the difference is, like, you know, the minor leaguers, you know, on the nine-hour bus rides, you know, eating bad food, staying in kind of shoddy hotels as part of that experience. So they're excited for, you know, kind of like the downtime. But in reality, the stress on the arm isn't probably dramatically different. So what I think we really need to do is we need to counsel guys that, hey, you got to get that at least that 8 to 10 weeks a year without a ball in your hand. It's a game changer for a couple reasons. First is because of what kind of stress it takes away. We know that we have passive restraints in our arm, right? So our ulnar collateral ligament is a passive restraint. The glenohumeral ligaments, the capsule in the front of the shoulder, those are passive restraints as well. And basically every time we throw a ball, every time we lay our arm back into that max external rotation position, we stretch those out, okay? We know the average pitcher gains external rotation over the course of the season. We know that elbow probably gets a little bit looser as well. And the second you stop throwing, you regain some of that passive stability. Those ligaments have a little bit of time to kind of regenerate, get back to some good resting stiffness that's going to protect you. So by taking a ball out of your hand, you're regaining passive stability without even knowing it. But what's even more important, though, is that that downtime from throwing is huge because it opens up a window of learning and motor control and strength. So effectively, you're able to get out of those asymmetrical patterns. You're able to get into good positions. You're able to create good rotator cuff strength. You're able to get good scapular stability. And you can't ever do those. It's like trying to change the oil on your car while you're still driving. It's just, you might be able to do it if you're really, really good, but it's just not an efficient way to get the job done. So I think when I look at the guys who have had good long-term athletic development, they've gotten time away from throwing, and they've been exposed to multiple sports, and that's a big part of what's made it possible to stay healthy long-term. Now, what I think is a really important add-on to that is there are probably going to be a lot of coaches out there, and even former players and things like that, who say, well, that's them being soft, right? They can't handle the workload or anything like that. Just because they're not throwing doesn't mean they're not working really, really hard, right? You can push baseball players very hard in the weight room. You can make improvements in a lot of different ways to build, both the athlete and the baseball player without having to throw and swing all the time. So I think it's important to realize that you're not just sitting around and doing nothing for 8 to 10 weeks. You're using it as an opportunity to really get ahead of things. And this is something you see over and over again. I mean, I remember talking to Sean Cole about his time at Arizona and how, one of the biggest things that they did to really help the program was push strength and conditioning really hard with their freshmen after their first years. You know, spending time on campus, they hit their innings and really changing their bodies there, that was huge for them. You see the guys at Vanderbilt, getting kids in early before the fall starts so they can get those, 6 or 8 weeks under their belt to really build a good foundation of strength and, work on whatever you need to work on from a movement standpoint. Like, if you can get that time each year and then also be really good about educating the athlete about, nutrition, in-season training, all that stuff, that's where all the pieces fit together. But what I think we wind up seeing is all of those other things become piecemeal because guys are trying to be everything to everybody. They're trying to play for multiple teams, and they're just kind of they're coasting on fumes by the time the summer ball rolls around.
I hate to move in that direction, but obviously you get to that point, now injuries become a little more rampant. And I know you're obviously very specific on how what you believe in terms of what those causes are, but there's also some preventative moves that players and coaches can really look at to kind of keep their players on the field and healthy. Can you want to dive into that?
If I have to look at like all of the things that we look at to try to keep guys healthy, there's certainly the things that we would do for any athlete, like sleep quality, proper nutrition, things along those lines. I'm a big believer in individualization on the arm care side of things. I think we see a lot of times when, a coach just hands out, here's a ready-to-print rotator cuff program, all you guys are going to do it. One thing that's actually interesting is a lot of guys have very unique presentation. You'll see some guys with, crazy military postures. They have really flat upper backs, and their shoulder blades are, stuck together. If you give a guy like that, a classic, down-and-back arm care program, you could make him worse. So I'm a big believer in trying to individualize stuff in terms of the way guys move. When you have a really loose-jointed guy, the last thing you want him to do is go through an aggressive team stretch where he's torquing those joints to end range and establishing more instability. So to those points, I'm big on takeaways, not just criticizing. If I'm a coach listening to this, the number one thing that I'm doing is I'm trying to create or nurture relationships with athletic trainers, physical therapists, strength and conditioning coaches who can help my program. Who are these guys that can take a look at my pitching staff and give me feedback on what they need to work on? How can I identify, the ones that are big time at risk? Who's the guy with that right shoulder that's 4 inches lower than the left? So I really do believe that, multiple minds are better than one. So we'll really encourage guys to to try to use those resources they have at their fingertips. So in the high school and the college setting, you know, 99% of the time there's an athletic trainer right nearby who can help out with manual therapy, arm care stuff, things along those lines with the pitching staff. But I think, you know, even beyond that, you got to really push hard and understand the management side. Kevin Arminio at Kennesaw State, the pitching coach there, is actually a good friend of mine. And Kevin came up and observed us back in, you know, in the, I think it was like the summer of 08 or summer of 09, and we've become great friends. And when he was here, I remember asking him, I was like, hey, you know, just out of curiosity, like, what are you looking to get out of coming up and hanging out here for a couple of days? And he's like, you know, the longer I've been at this, the more I realize it's less about just mechanics and calling pitches, and it's more about managing the pitcher. I was like, that, it's like, I should, like, set up and put it on the wall. It's, you know, it's just, yeah, there's the guy that goes out and throws 90 pitches once a week, and it takes place over 3 hours. What's happening in the other, you know, 6.9 days of the week? So I think
right.
He really grasped that early on, and it was something that was eye-opening for me, is that, hey, you know, if we want to keep our guys healthy, we've got to understand all the other pieces, not just what happens on the mound. Because, you know, there are guys that, I mean, look at Chris Sale. Like, I think Sale's really, really fun to watch. I mean, that's not a deliver you would ever teach to one of your athletes. But, you know, you're also not going to overhaul it when he's 9-0 and absolutely shoving, probably been the best pitcher in baseball this year. So what can you do in a situation like that? I think there are a lot of, you know, guys who have massive IQs on Twitter who would say, well, you overhaul his mechanics. There's only one way to keep him healthy. You know, if it's me, I'm saying, how can I physically prepare a guy like that to make sure that his body is able to withstand his mechanics no matter how funky they are? You know, so I think you have to manage each situation very individually. And obviously he's been a guy who's been pretty healthy thus far and hopefully can stay that way. So there's no easy answer, and that's the thing that's frustrating about it. But what it speaks to is one of the reasons our business has grown and our guys have had good results is that we try to view everybody individually. We try to sit down, do an evaluation with all of them, talk about their history, what's worked, what hasn't, and determine how we really fit in.
You kind of made reference to it, and I think this is, again, when we do these podcasts, you know, especially from the ABCA perspective, we want to try to give our coaches as much information as they can. I know it's tough in a podcast format, but for the coaches out there that are small college or they're high school or they're academy guys and the budgets aren't there, or maybe they don't have a strength and conditioning coach on staff, and we always know where that falls. That's right back on the assistant coach or the head coach to come up with that plan and really guide that team through development. But how can they proceed, Eric, if you had to give them kind of a maybe some resources or point them in the right direction or maybe just an overall general idea of how to proceed with a strength and conditioning program in that situation, how would you guide them?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is that there are always people who are looking to help and get involved. And that's something that gets really overlooked is you'd be surprised at how many local physical therapists or graduate, you know, athletic training students, things like that want to get involved and are willing to volunteer and assist, whether it's in evaluations or in actual programming. I think what we see very commonly is, you know, we see maybe someone who has a baseball academy or whatever, and then the pitching coach just says, hey, we're going to do some strength and conditioning stuff on the side, and I'll jump in and I'll supervise it. Maybe it's one program pasted up on the wall or written on the dry erase board. Everybody does the same thing. So it's very well-intentioned, but it's also, you know, kind of vanilla. You know, it's not really anything sexy. You know, maybe it's consistency and all that. It's a matter of convenience. So, you know, if you do kind of like that kind of stuff, you're not going to get the dramatic improvements. You're not going to get the dramatic reductions in injury prevention. Maybe you get some good benefits, just nothing anything revolutionary. So I do think that there are places, there are always guys that are looking to get more involved and work with athletes and things like that. So what I always tell those people is that, you know, it would be crazy for a physical therapist to think that, hey, I can overhaul somebody's pitching mechanics, right? If somebody's got a really bad delivery, the PT would never do that. They would look to a pitching coach in the private sector or something like that to find help. So I think coaches just need to realize that it's always okay to ask for help. It's, you know, if anything, you're working hard to find the best answers for your athletes. I think at the end of the day, if you do that, you can always sleep better at night. So, you know, as a strength and conditioning coach, I have no problem referring out. I mean, I send people to massage therapists, chiropractors, physical therapists, pitching coaches, sports psychologists, you know, like on a weekly basis. And I think that ability to stay humble and, you know, be willing to, you know, kind of work with other people has been a big part of our success.
You know, there's a couple other realms I want to get to on this. And I think, and we're kind of referencing it earlier in terms of the workload that's being placed on these guys, but there's players out there. And again, we're hitting that
you know, end of high school, and then we're getting into the summer. And at some point this summer, Eric, and you know this, players that are out there, you know, across the entire world, they're going to hit this period of dead arm, and they're really going to absolutely hit the wall. They're going as hard as they can. Like you referenced, they're running through the gamut of all the different events where they're trying to really promote themselves and find the right fit, do those things, but they're going to hit a wall. So give kind of at least from the cause and effect of that, but also what do they do when the pitcher has it? What can a coach help that kid with?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the interesting thing about dead arm is it's somewhat of like a garbage term, for lack of a better term. What I think is actually really interesting is if you look a little bit deeper into this, it can mean a lot of different things, right? And I've actually done some research on like the history of it. The first time dead arm was actually ever mentioned was 1987, and it was a study where they actually referred to recurrent anterior shoulder dislocations. And then in that same year, there was another set of researchers that related it to thoracic outlet syndrome. And then literally 13 years later, in kind of like a landmark paper on slap tears in the shoulder, they called dead arm syndrome the type 2 slap lesion. So they basically said that this is someone who's anterior dislocated. This is someone who has a neural or a vascular issue of more proximal, so neck slash upper ribcage origin, to dealing with something like, all right, the biceps tendon has avulsed off of the superior labrum. So these are like brilliant researchers, MDs, guys doing shoulder surgeries all the time, and they can't even agree on what dead arm is. So
right.
What are the chances that a high school kid whose velo has gone from 89 to 84, who can't figure it out, like they don't know. So what often winds up happening is they take the wrong solution to the problem. So what we'll very commonly see is, you know, regardless, I think we can agree that dead arm is probably a fatigue problem, right? So it's fatigue. Mm-hmm. Either there's something in place that's not allowing them to display their full potential. The classic solution has always been, well, throw more. You know, like get out and long toss more, get more aggressive, make your bullpen longer, do this, that, and the other. And what you never want to do is take a fitness solution to a fatigue problem. So I'm going to say that again. You never want to take a fitness solution to a fatigue problem. What you need to do is you need to pry and look a lot deeper. Because athletes can say dead arm for a lot of different reasons, right? They might say the velocity is down. That's the most common, but it might be a loss of command. It could be a struggle to kind of get loose, get warm before an outing. It could be the guys aren't bouncing back between outings. Some guys who may feel like they have instability, like the shoulders like giving out. Maybe it's just like a lot of soreness. Maybe it's actual pain or discomfort. You know, some of your guys that report with like numbness, tingling, or like a heavy arm may actually be like a thoracic outlet candidate. So when you have like this pronounced reduction in velocity slash command, and then you accompany it with kind of like some of these physical symptoms, you've really got to dig deep, right? So if I told you, you know, hey, you've got a really serious headache, like, and we just say, all right, take some Advil for it. Yeah, that might help the cause, but at the same time, we don't know. You could have a brain tumor, right? You could have fractured your skull wrestling with your kids or something like that. There's all these other differential diagnoses that come about. So, you know, with that said, I do a lot of prying when I hear about dead arm. You know, I want to know what's your injury history, what do you mean by dead arm, how long has it been going on for, what have you tried to do to remedy it, have you had any, like, diagnostic imaging, have you changed your routine recently, you know, whether it's throwing or strength training or conditioning or stretching mobility or nutrition or sleep quality, you know, your throwing schedule, things along those lines, because I want to know, hey, are you excited to throw, are you anxious, are you worried, are you apathetic about it, has there anything you've done that's made you feel better? Do you have numbness? Do you have tingling? Do you have pain? Do you have cold hands? Have you had mono or any other recent illness? Have you lost weight? Do you have knots in your upper traps or any other kind of trigger points? You know, and we want to ask about like workload over the past, you know, 12 to 24 months. So this is a very multifactorial, crazy situation. It's not just as simple as saying you need to throw more. So that's something that's always driven me bonkers, is that the solution that most coaches employ has been to try to add more fitness, when in reality you could be putting fitness on top of pretty high-level dysfunction. You know, a couple years ago we had a kid who came in who had, like, a lot of, like, sternum pain when he was throwing. And it was like the weirdest thing. And, you know, in hindsight, I made a good decision. I was like, you know, let's just get this checked out. And he went and saw a local ortho, and the guy tracked it back. He'd had mono like 10 months earlier, and he had some residual inflammation. He had costochondritis, put him on a high dose of Aleve for about a week, and everything went away. If I had just told that kid, you know, hey, throw through it, you know, just push harder, let's do more push-ups, whatever, it's not going to solve it. It's actually going to make it worse. So right. My rule of thumb, never take a fitness solution to a fatigue problem, and you always have to assume that dead arm is a fatigue problem when you first start. So when I hear from a college guy, you know, and he's saying, listen, like my velocity's down or whatever, my first solution for him is I say, listen, let's, you know, I ask all the questions to say, hey, is this something that really warrants you going and seeing a doctor or your athletic trainer or whatever it is? Usually what I try to do is I try to go conservative first. I say, listen, just get a ball out of your hand for the next couple of days. I want you to absolutely crush calories, you know, eat everything in sight, just because most of the time, you know, drops in body weight, not eating enough, or where we see guys really falling off in season. I said, I want you to try to get in bed as early as you can. Try to get 10, 12 hours sleep the next couple nights. Also get in, see either your athletic trainer or physical therapist or massage therapist. Just get some good soft tissue work, kind of like feel good stuff to get the blood flowing. And then, you know, in a matter of a couple days, let's get back and either play catch, maybe throw a bullpen, do something short so you can build a little bit of confidence, build some arm speed back up. And invariably, like 80 or 90% of the time, it fixes things right there. And usually what it is just this accumulated volume of stress that makes things tougher and tougher. Now, if you have guys that have numbness, tingling, those are ones you refer out, and you want to make sure that you're screening all that stuff. But, you know, I think it's so, so important to really get back to the basics of, like, why would guys not throw hard? Because they're tired. So why would we say if you're tired, we're going to do more fitness stuff? And, you know,
right.
you'll invariably see coaches that tell guys to go out and run more or do more long toss or throw more. In reality, the exact opposite is in many cases the solution.
I always like this because I think as coaches, we to have a frame of reference on it, but it's really tough. Like you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of information, even on just social media. But if you scoured the internet, you could find a wealth of information on strength and conditioning. But, you know, Eric, and you know this to be true, a lot of it's 12 different ways. You need to kind of give us our listeners and our coaches, you know, just your perspective in terms of the success you've had, the training regimens that you've used specifically to those points. What would be the kind of the game plan that you would suggest to our coaches moving forward?
Yeah. So I think historically baseball strength and conditioning programs have gone in one or two directions, right? They've either been, here's the football program, go do it. So bench press, back squat, clean was basically the rule of the house. And then I think there's also been the exact opposite, right? We've excessively coddled guys. We've given them, you know, basically these ready-to-print rotator cuff programs and just sent them on their way. So it's basically like glorified rehab. I'm a big believer there's a happy medium between the two, is that, you know, as long as you take into account the unique demands of the sport and make it, you know, dictate your exercise selection and you determine, you know, is this the right time of year and who am I working with, you can actually push baseball players incredibly hard. You know, it might mean going from back squat to front squat. It might mean, you know, a million different things. But I think what we have is we have people that go to an extreme. And I think the answer usually lies in the middle. We aren't big fans of Olympic lifts, not because I don't think they're good exercises. We might use them in other sports, you know, working with our football guys or hockey guys or whatever it may be. My actually biggest criticism of is that I don't think the carryover is nearly as strong to rotational sport athletes as you might think. Power development is actually pretty plane specific, and there's some good research from 2012 in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research that actually demonstrated this. But really, you're not going to get awesome carryover from doing a lot of Olympic lifts, vertical jumps, things like that to a rotational sport. So that's why we tend to be a lot more specific with our power development stuff. You know, lateral hops for distance, rotational med ball stuff, those things seem to have a lot more carryover for us. And on top of that, we don't necessarily have to deal with as many potential problems with respect to, you know, wrist and shoulder stuff, you know, elbows being put in a bad position when you're trying to catch a snatch overhead, something like that. So not inherently bad exercise. It's just not something that I think is maybe a great use of training time with this specific population.
The last little thing I want to kind of touch on, because you're throwing information out and you've done such a great job. You've written over, you know, boost your ego here, man. You've written over 500 articles. You're really getting stuff out and information out and sharing the wealth, which is a staple of the baseball community. We really like to share and let guys put stuff out and kind of sort through it and figure out what you want to use. But the two in particular, and I think that coaches can reference to, and we'll do a good job of getting this out on
social media was, you know, the reasons that you have that when coaches see velo decrease over a season, but there's also reasons that could lead to an increase over season. Obviously, we don't want to dive into every single one of those reasons, but kind of talk through some of the generics inside both those articles that you put out.
Yeah, you know, I think the first one, you know, to give you a little background, I'm born and raised in Maine, so I grew up a, you know, kind of a Red Sox fan, and, you know, when I was first getting to college was the Pedro Martinez heyday. So you prayed that when you went to a Red Sox game you were going to see Pedro. And
sure.
What do we know? Pedro always struggled in April. Because it was colder, right? Velo always spikes once the weather warms up. So I think that's something to really consider, especially in the college realm where, you know, guys are sometimes playing games in late January. You know, so those can certainly be factors you have to consider, is just that, you know, the nature of velo improves as weather gets better. And you see that in the major leagues as well. So I think that's one thing to consider. A lot of guys, like we talked about with the passive restraint discussion a little bit earlier, you get a little bit more external rotation back as the season goes on, as innings kind of climb up a little bit, and that's something that can definitely facilitate improvements in velocity. Some guys need to kind of find their mechanics and get into routines. And I think also, you know, the more the season goes on, the more you're pitching in meaningful games. Like I've seen guys in spring training who literally can't throw 90 on backfields, and then they go out into bigger game scenarios with people in the stands, batters in the boxes, and they're 93 to 95. It's one of those things that's always blown me away. So I think just the level of competition certainly plays into it as well. So there are a lot of reasons that velo can go up over the course of a season. Likewise, there are a lot of reasons that pitching velocity can go down. You know, sometimes you'll see guys that go from a starting role to a relieving role, and they'll spike a little bit there as well. So I wouldn't say that there's one answer for everybody, but it's definitely something that you'll see sometimes.
Eric, man, this has been a phenomenal podcast for us in terms of getting some information out. And I know that it'd be a great resource for our coaches to come back to and give them some insight into what's really going on in the strength and conditioning realm, which, again, as baseball coaches, we see the progression and where it's moving. We need to be better in that aspect and have a better frame of reference to help our players. But we really appreciate you being on Calls from the Clubhouse with us, Eric. And obviously, we wish you all the best and hope that we cross paths again here very soon.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for having me.
And that wraps up another great episode of our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. We want to sincerely thank Eric Cressy from Cressy Sports Performance for being on with us, giving us some tremendous insight into the strength and conditioning programs that they use at Cressy Sports Performance, but more importantly, giving our coaches great insight into how to keep our players healthy and, most importantly, keeping them on the field playing our game. If you're interested in previous episodes we've done, go to our website, abca.org. You can click on the Resources tab at the top, and you'll see our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast link. You can download it directly off that page. You can also head over to iTunes, and you can subscribe to our podcast. It'll show up on your phone each time we do one. Give us a 5-star rating. Put us a review on there so we can make sure we're servicing our members. You can also find us on Twitter, at ABCA1945. You can find us on Facebook under the same title, ABCA1945. And if you've got interesting topics or coaches that you think would be great for our podcast, please feel free to email me. My email is sheets, sheets@abca.org. We'd love to correspond with you, talk through it, and see if we can't get more of our great coaches on our podcast. If you haven't done so already, we hope we can add you to the list and join over 8,000 baseball coaches worldwide that are passionate ABCA members. We also hope that as you look forward to January of 2017, you're planning on January 5th through the 8th being with us. We're going to head out to Anaheim, California for our annual convention. You get a great opportunity to spend time networking with great coaches from all over the world, and we hope to see you there. In the meantime, if we can do anything for you, please reach out. We appreciate what you're doing for the game of baseball, and thank you for your support of this project.